I sure hope you're hungry.
Ooh, I'm starving.
Wash those hands, pull up a chair, and secure that feed bag. Because it's time to listen to Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss attempt to use human language to converse with and pick the brains of other developers. I thought there was going to be food. So buckle up and grab that O-shit handle, because this ride is going to get wild. This is the Syntax Supper Club.
Welcome to Syntax. On this Friday Supper Club, we're going to be talking to Yagiz Nizipli all about Node.js performance, all kinds of stuff. And Yagiz has been doing a ton of really amazing things. He's been a voting member of the Node.js Technical Steering Committee, a voting member of the OpenJS Foundation, Cross Project Council, the founder of the Node.js Performance Team, the author and maintainer of Fast Query String, 150 plus commits on Node.js, and he's the reason why we have .env in Node.js.
Yes.
So welcome to the show. How's it going? What's up? How you doing?
Good, good. Yeah, thank you for inviting me and hosting me today. It's good. I was just getting used to my new job at Sentry, so mostly learning new stuff. Like, how's everything with you?
Yeah, going great over here. And I've been seeing on Twitter your PRs you're submitting. It seems like you hit the ground running over there, doing some pretty major PRs right out of the gate. So that's pretty incredible.
The easiest thing that an engineer could do is to replace or refactor or rewrite something. So that's what I'm basically doing, is that replacing old tools with new tools so that we have the performance boost and maybe save some money while doing that. So
nice.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, we're gonna talk about I think kind of like two main things today, and then we'll see where that goes. First, I want to talk about like performance and how you figure out how things are slow and how you figure out how to make things faster. As well as I want to talk a lot about just Node.js in general. Like, you've been part of, maybe you can explain to us your involvement in Node.js, but we know you've been, we're a founding member of the Perf team, and you're pretty heavily involved, as well as we have some pretty exciting announcements of stuff coming to Node that you're going to leak to the audience, right?
Yep. That's true.
So, like, what's your involvement with Node.js?
Right now, I am a Node.js Technical Steering Committee member. And on top of that, around last year, December, a year ago, I founded the Node.js Performance Team with the focus of improving Node.js performance and the crucial parts. Up until September or August 2023, I was the performance strategic initiative champion, and I resigned 2-3 months ago from that. But yeah, I mostly work on performance, and if I had some time and if the tasks are non-controversial, I try to add new features, but I mostly work on like performance stuff.
Awesome. And let's talk about that real quickly. Is like, you implemented .env support into Node.js, and that was like so well received by the community. It was one of those like, yes, thank you. And it feels like Node lately has been saying, you know what, maybe we should add some of these features that people are doing. Like, I feel like a long time ago, it was like, no, like, this is part of the community, the tooling, you can install a package to do that type of thing. And recently, I feel like Node has switched to saying, you know what, maybe we should make the DX a little bit and bake a few things in like .env. Has there been a shift in Node at all for that?
Yeah. So in the past, so I started contributing Node a year and a half ago, maybe around 2 years ago. Okay. So I didn't see any specific shift from my side, but what I could say is that because Node is an open source project and it's maintained by random people around the globe, and because it runs on democracy and like people can reject and either approve or reject any changes,
yeah.
I think the other general opinion of Node core collaborators have changed, and that's why we're seeing those kinds of new features right now. And on top of that, we have attracted more C++ developers in the past couple of months. And as a result of that, we have these drastic changes because of the performance gains and ease of implementing those kinds of features. But yeah, .env is one of those features that I've developed and got really positive feedback. So I initially started contributing to Node because I rewrote the URL parser, which had much more impact than .env file, but because it wasn't open and it was not deliberately seen or easily noticeable by engineers, it didn't get that much attention.
The URL parser is the like new URL, and then you get the everything, the port, the path name, the search params, all of that. And initially I was like, well, like, isn't that part of, that's not part of V8. That's a browser API, right? That's been implemented in Node?
Yes. So that's a Chromium implementation. And because we don't have Chromium and we have V8, we basically implemented it with the help of Daniel Lemire, a professor from Canada, and released a library called Ada, which is named after my daughter. So every time you call a new URL, it actually runs 20,000 lines of C++ code. So it's not as simple as it. And the impact is extremely huge because if you run a node index.js and it doesn't even have any files in it, it actually creates new URL five times. If you run a fetch, it creates five more times. If you import any modules in ESM, it initializes more than I can count. So URL is everywhere, and we just don't know it because there isn't anybody like me that tells you that those kinds of small things, they're extremely impactful for performance. And it's mostly like that by 1,000 cuts is the correct explanation of the whole situation.
What kind of like sick person writes 20,000 lines of C in URL?
What could it possibly be doing in all of those lines? Like, what is it doing? Yeah.
URL, so there's a group called WebVG, which is web application bubble. So it's like Safari, Chrome, Firefox developers, they come together and they release this URL specification. It basically contains, it basically is a state machine, but a really glorified and extremely unperformant state machine. And in order to make that performant, we used the most up-to-date technologies and methodologies in order to speed things up. That's why we have this change. So so I can give you a quick example. If you have https://google.com, it goes character by character, iterate through the whole string. When it sees a colon at https colon, it says that, okay, the protocol state has ended. So right now I can have an authority state, a path state, a file path state, or so on and so forth. So in that scenario, it checks for an at character because if you have username colon password at localhost, for example, that username is the username and password is the password. So it checks for the at character, but it couldn't find it. So it goes back to the colon. And then it sees that there's a 2/ character. This means that right now we are in the host name state. So it goes to the host name state until it sees a colon, which is the starting point of port, or / which is the starting point of path name, or a question mark, which is the starting point of query, or a hash character, which is the starting point of fragment. It differentiates and goes through all of those layers. And each of those states has different encoding and decoding parameters. This means that if you have a space character in query parameter, it's translated into %20. This is because a lot of people on Google Chrome, they go into the toolbar and instead of actually writing a URL, they are writing yagiz space nizipli or syntax space fm. And that needs to be translated into something that is easily encoded. So
just all kinds of, I don't think people realize how complicated URLs can be. It's the URL is the original state machine, or it's the original state manager, right? You can put so much in it. And I probably every developer in their life has just said, I'm just going to split it on the question mark and then split it on the equals and loop over it. And boom, I've got the query params. And then you realize, oh, there's 7 million edge cases down. Is there like a test suite for all the different possible URLs? And do you know how many tests are in there?
Yeah. So just yesterday, I was invited to the Web Platform Tests Organization, which is the organization that maintains the tests across all browsers.
Yeah.
So it has a URL has around maybe 3,000 or 2,000 tests.
Wow.
Ada URL parser adds more tests on top of that,
wow,
which influenced other libraries as well, including Boost. For example, Boost ported all of our Ada tests to their code base, and they found 6 different bugs in their code by just porting our tests. So it's extremely, it's an extremely complex and underrated part of programming that we all accept it as a cost that we always have to pay.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. But it's not. So.
So you mentioned that those kind of things might get overlooked, right? How do you go about finding those types of performance issues or performance areas that you could even begin to start figuring out, you know, untangling the web of what makes it faster?
So if you ask this to 100 different engineers, they would, like 90 or 80% of them will say that I will just run a profiler and I will just look into the flame graph and see what part that takes the most time and I will just try to optimize that. But I personally, I'm more interested in having much more impact than the flame graph that I'm currently looking at. This means that I like to look at to the code that no one is there to look into that code, and they will accept that because it's working, it's okay. So this is how I started working on URL, because it was a trivial task. I also assumed that it was a really easy task as others, but it resulted in writing 3 or 4 different implementations. So I basically select what is the most fundamental thing that runs on every part of the code base. That might be URL or file system operations or query string parser or those kinds of things that we always have to run. And I try to optimize that. And yeah, that's what I did.
And that's typically done in C++, right? So for anyone who doesn't know, Node.js is not written in JavaScript. It's written primarily in C++. And some of the APIs are written in JavaScript. And part of what you do is say, okay, this API is slow because it's been implemented via Node libraries in JavaScript. So you can then take a library that's been implemented in JavaScript and just rewrite it to be native, meaning it runs in C++?
Yeah, so the thing is, most of the non-crucial APIs, non-performance-wise, not important but not crucial APIs are written in JavaScript, and most of the performance-wise required tasks are written in C++. I basically, and whenever you call a C++ function from JavaScript, there is this cost that you always have to pay, which is the serialization of the data that you are passing. If it's a string, if it's a really complex data structure, we always pay for this cost. It's like calling JSON stringify and converting it to string and then passing string to somewhere else and then calling JSON parse. So mm-hmm. that cost is a must. And I basically try to find what is the most optimal way of paying this price, but also making it fast. So not always moving them to C++ side is always a good side, but most of the time, most optimizations in Node.js are a product of these move. Like, for example, just recently, we had maybe 30, 40 different PRs from 40 different collaborators in Node, improving the error path of Node FS modules. So we were previously calling a C++ function from JavaScript, and that C++ function was returning an object, and if that object had an error key, then we were throwing error. But if we moved that error state to C++ side, we realized that we could improve the error, the faulty path of these functions by 100 or like 150% speed it up. So yeah, these kinds of things are what is the most impactful one.
Wow. So what are you using to measure those changes to know if you're having an impact or not?
So benchmarks. We basically run thousands of benchmarks in Node. On top of that, it's important to find the edge cases that you pass. So invalid state, valid state, and whatever different inputs does it take, we try to enumerate them. And we have a dedicated benchmark CI in the Node.js infrastructure that we run these kinds of things. And because that machine is extremely old, it reflects the worst case scenario of the optimization, and which provides a good baseline for giving a proper reasoning for that particular change.
And do you have to run those benchmarks on different hardware as well? I remember like probably 10 years ago, one of the Node team members was running a bunch of Raspberry Pis a bunch of Raspberry Pis in their office as part of the test suite, because that was one of the things they targeted at the time, was how fast does it run on a Raspberry Pi?
Yeah, so right now I think we have maybe 20, 30 different CI machines. We have only one benchmark CI. This is mostly because we are Node.js is an open source organization, and there isn't any company behind it that could give us those kinds of benchmark, the big machines to run those benchmarks. And mostly we don't write hardware specific code in Node.js, which means that we don't write specific instructions for Neon, which is macOS, and for SSE 2 for Windows machines or x64 machines. In particular for Ada URL parser, we have made those optimizations. That's why Ada is extremely fast, but that requires to have a direct access to the machine itself, and that's where Daniel's expertise comes in. And because he's a professor and working and have all of these different machines, he helped and optimized for different architectures.
So let's talk about, like, there's everybody listening to this is a web developer. They're writing JavaScript every day. Like, there's probably very few people listening that write C++ in their day to day. I'm just curious about at what point you should start caring about performance. So an example I have is I'll often have an array and I need to distill it down. So I'll run a filter on it, and then I'll need to map over it and add some data. And then I might chain a couple of maps and a couple of filters together, because it's much easier for me to reason about it, to debug it, to read the actual code, versus I could probably do it in a single reduce, but it's going to be much more complex. And I'll often opt for the multiple map filter reduces, and people will say, hey, like, that's, what about performance? And my answer to that is I'm looping over three spans on a page. I don't think it matters. So do you have any sort of guidelines as to like when you should start caring about these things?
So performance is a mindset. It's not something that I can turn on or turn off.
Yeah.
Even though that particular code is called maybe one or two times in the lifespan of that whole project.
Yeah.
I basically care about writing the best code that I could write for that particular portion. But in order to answer that question, let me rephrase the question for a different industry. Let's say we talk about security. When should you care about security? Would you care for security if you get hacked? Yes. Would you care for security if you don't get hacked at all? No, you won't care about it. But because you don't get hacked, you don't look into that particular approach to your code, and then you don't realize that you're already hacked. So this is this is like a prisoner's dilemma. And also a chicken and the egg problem as well, because up until to the point that you care about performance, you don't know that it's slow. And if you look into that and realize that it's slow, then you change how you write your code and you try to optimize it. So it's not about iterating or calling map or filter multiple times. It's about the principles. How many times, like what is the big O notation of this for loop that I'm iterating? Am I iterating O2N or O5N, or what is the, is it growing exponentially or so on and so forth? So the question is, if you know those kinds of things, and if you also make the deliberate choice of doing it, I think that's okay. But as to summarize, it's not always like a black and white scenario. But for me, when you learn those kinds of things, you can't turn them off. that's why I'm here. That's yeah. what it led yeah. me to all of those performance things.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So if you're writing like a loop in JavaScript, and you think, should I spread this thing into an array and then slice the items out of it, or should I do it a different way? What would you do in that case? Would you go to like JS Bench or JS Perf or something like that and write a test case and run it 100,000 times to see if there's any difference between the two of them?
If you iterate and if you call a slice, this means that you copy the memory twice. So this means if you have 1,000 array, then you have another memory as well. So if you are doing this a lot of times, then you are basically triggering garbage collection a lot of times, and that becomes a V8 problem. So, and because V8 is a JIT, which corresponds to just-in-time compiler, it's extremely hard for V8 to optimize those kinds of codes. So what I basically do is that I basically try to write it as fast as I can, with using less memory as possible, and then I benchmark that particular portion. But the question is not about benchmarking the whole thing. I benchmark the whole process, for example, parsing a URL or getting or read file sync. I basically do it that it's like an integration test. Instead of calling that particular function, you call everything, and then you realize what is the percentage of the time that I spend on this particular function. That's what flame graphs gives us. And in that portion, if it corresponds to 10%, but you spend 90% of the time on V8 or any other function, you realize that there's much that you can do. There's limited things that you can do in order to improve this function. And then you realize that you give up. And that becomes an educated decision rather than any emotional one.
Yeah, I think learning how to read a flame graph is a very good skill for anyone to have. So I had some issues. Cloudflare Worker, they give you 50 milliseconds. And I was using some library, and it kept going over, like kept going 80 milliseconds. And I distilled it down to simply just creating an object was creating 80 milliseconds. And I was like, this is ridiculous, right? And like, it might not. That's a good, really good example of like your mindset of performance first, because whoever wrote that code that caused that 80 millisecond instantiation probably was not intentionally trying to make it 80 milliseconds, but sort of happened by accident and it wasn't caught. I was posting on the GitHub and a bunch of people got the flame graphs out, and it was one function that was being called that was taking like 99% of the actual thing. And the flame graph was very visual to show it. And I was like, man, like, I don't know if I would have ever been able to figure out, okay, it's obviously this part. I can comment out the function call, but you got to go deeper than that.
So the question is, because I contributed and read a lot of those Node.js functions, Node.js internals, right now I know the, not a numeric value, but I know the overhead of calling a function. And with this knowledge, I tend to think towards saying that, like, okay, if I call this function, it will make 2 C++ calls. But if I do this one, it will make 1. And depending on the usage, this might be faster or not. And then the question becomes much more clearer. And you start to look into the flame graph less, unless it's extremely specific thing. Or you have a really big project, but you have no idea what's going on, then you dive into the flame graph.
We talked to Jared Sumner from Bun, And obviously, Bunda is very performance minded, and they always post these graphs that are 1,000 times faster than Node.js. And we asked him like how is it possible that you can make it so much faster? And his answer to that is that he handles like lots of common use cases in the code base. So like as I understand it, there will be simply like an if statement for common use case. Oh, if it's an array of one thing, we don't need to do this work. Is that a common thing to do in performance, is to just upfront check for these perf wins?
Yeah. So that's what we call a happy path, which means that like what's the most the positive path towards a function execution that goes. And for example, if you call the read file sync, the default value of encoding is UTF-8. And you know that most people call read file sync and they just want to get UTF-8. So if you add a specific if case and say that if encoding is equal to UTF-8 and you call a specific function super optimized for UTF-8, then you have a performance win. This is what I did maybe 6 months ago in read file sync, which improved the read file sync by 40-50% or something. So this is what we commonly do as well. You basically look into what users do or let's say go to Webpack, just if you want to optimize FS, make sure, like point out how many times each FS functions get called and with what arguments. You try to find the most common ancestors, the most common values for that, and try to optimize for that. And then you will have a significant boost in Webpack.
The happy path.
Yeah.
And another one I hear, and maybe you can explain what that this is in performance world, is the hot path.
Hot path is if that particular path is called a lot of times, that's what we call a hot path as well.
Okay.
So happy path is towards like the positive outcome of this function. For example, when you call an FS read file sync, you don't assume that it will throw an error. So because it's like if you make like a probability analysis, you will see that 95% of the times if you call a read file sync in any application, it will not throw an error because the developer already checks if it exists or not. But on that 20%, it will throw an error. So in that case, you ask yourself, this is a much more detailed application, that detailed explanation for happy path is that, should you optimize for the error path? No, you should optimize for the happy path because that's the succeed path. And then we have this hot path, which is the UTF-8. So yeah, I should have used this example instead of the happy path.
That's good.
I recently saw that you made a PR on the Sentry code base to replace Webpack with RSPack. I've been seeing RSPack pop up a whole bunch. Is that something that you think is ready for prime time use as a drop-in?
To summarize, for those who doesn't know, I replaced Sentry's Webpack build with RSPack that comes with SWC and it's all written in Rust, so it's extremely fast. The downside is that it has some weird bugs and to answer your question, I don't think it's ready to be used by a project with the size of Sentry because it's any sort of issue with minimizers or any sort of issue with CSS or whatever, it's going to have huge impacts on the company. So I wouldn't use it for any company with the size of Sentry, but I would use it for my own personal projects. And because it's extremely easy to migrate from Webpack to RSPack, it's also a really good choice because you don't need to change a lot about your deployment.
Oh, here's a question. And this is something that I saw on one of your pull requests is like, what's more important and how do you decide what's more important? Is how fast something runs or how big the bundle is? Is it worth adding more code, therefore inflating the bundle size as a trade-off for faster code base? And I know the answer is probably it depends, but I'd be curious to see if you have any thoughts on that.
If it's a front-end application, bundle size is a lot more impactful. But I think the most recent example that I can give you is that Rust has this option to optimize for space or optimize for speed. And if you optimize for speed, this means that you will have a really high storage bundle size because you add all of these large binaries in order to optimize for those each paths. But if you go for storage, then your application becomes significantly slower, but the bundle size is extremely low because you're using the most native APIs that the operating system offers. I mostly, depending on the usage, depending on the API that we are calling, and depending on the impact of that function, I go for speed. I don't go for storage because you can always buy more SSD. You can always buy like more hard disk and more storage. But even though if you have the latest computers, like 32 gig machines with 10, 15 core CPUs, if the application that you're running is not optimized for running fast, then there's much that you can do with even with the fastest architecture and fastest computer. So, yeah, I would go for speed at any time. And this is what we did with Ada. And I think this is what is going for Node.js as well.
Awesome.
I just wanted to have a quick question because I know you mentioned that you have been committing to Node for what you said. How long was it?
2 years?
Not that long, right? 2 years, yeah?
Almost 2 years, I guess.
Almost 2 years. What's it like working on a project of that nature? I get the vibe that working on Node can be kind of like thankless at sometimes. Do you get that? Or what's it like?
So it's extremely beneficial for personal development. Because you basically have access to a lot of really smart and intelligent people that wants to improve the code that you've written because you share a common thing with that person. But in terms of the in terms of impact, it's impactful both personal and both worldwide. But it's the most you never get any positive feedback about. From people all around the globe, and most of the time you even get crucified is the correct word, I guess, because of what you're doing. And because it's a free software, people and use it, and because they're using it on their most crucial applications, mm-hmm. they have this expectancy towards it, and that makes it a really really hard job to do it because you are contributing it on your own time. I'm not getting paid to contribute Node.js, but people don't understand that and assume that Node.js is a company and Node.js is an organization, but it's not.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, it's extremely lonely that I can say that.
Yeah, yeah, I get that.
But if I look into the past, I can easily say that the changes that I did or any contributor to Node.js did, it impacts the world in a size that we can't comprehend. This means that because of the performance improvements, we have the environment is a lot better because we are releasing less carbon dioxide because of the usages of that computers and because of the impact. Because it's literally used everywhere. So that's really good.
Yeah, it's crazy the scale making a change can have on things like that. I remember years ago, I had a friend, he worked for a company that sent out millions and millions of emails to, I can say it was to BlackBerry. And every time BlackBerry had to email every single one of their users, they had to design like an email template and whatever. And they distilled it down to every single character would cost them an extra dollar in bandwidth in order to send it out from their data centers. And it's wild that such a small thing, including one extra character blown up by 200 million users or however many users they had would cost so much. So you think about that in perf, if a CPU is literally running 20% less because you've improved this common use case, that's major, both in terms of how much energy it's using, as well as the amount of money people are spending to run this compute.
Yeah, and just recently I realized that because Electron uses Node.js, even improving URL parsing or file system operations by 5%, you directly have an impact to billion people, because WhatsApp Web, Discord, Microsoft Teams, they all use Node.js, and their applications start a little bit faster because of the change that you did on that particular code. And that's what keeps Node.js going. And because it's not company owned, and it's community owned, it's it puts Node.js in a really crucial and important path.
Yeah.
I always think how funny that is with, you know, like when you go have a piece of hardware and they have like a licenses section that show everything. Often I'll go through the licenses of the Instagram app or the infotainment of my desktop, and I'll be like, there's people's names in this piece of hardware that we've had on the podcast. And I would just love to one day be able to like go to a friend or people who work on browsers and be like, hey, do you see how that text is aligned there? I worked on that. And every single person in the world that is holding an iPhone and seeing left aligned text or Flexbox or Grid or using a library to fetch data, be like, I wrote that code and now it's being used by a good chunk of the world.
So the funny thing is, around 3-4 months ago, I was applying for a green card. And because I was under the O-1 visa, which is an extraordinary talent visa type for US, I was applying for a green card for extraordinary talent. And one of the requirements is that your licensed software needs to be used by a really well-known company. So I basically spent 2-3 months Googling every day, trying to find my name on one of those licenses so I can show it to the reviewers of the US government. And I recently found out that Oracle is using Festify, and because Festify uses Fast Query String, my name is included in the Oracle's one of the like the manuals. And it's like extremely funny. And we were talking with Matteo in NodeConf a month ago, and I was like, hey man, like your name is on Oracle, and he was like, yeah, so what? he was so used to it, and I was like, oh my god, this is really weird. But like this is the reality. Like everybody uses open source libraries, and they put it license. But the weird thing is, no JS license is included in those packages.
Oh yeah.
So if even though a lot of people use Node.js, you will never see Node.js license in those functions. But they include a 300 line npm package license, but not include Node.js, which is sort of weird. But
that is bizarre.
That's the reality.
I remember years ago there was a blog post from Daniel, who is the creator and maintainer of Curl. And just the amount of emails he gets from random people who don't understand what Curl is, because they find it on their device or they find a file on their computer somewhere being like, you hacked my computer.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really the reality of the situation. And even my own parents or my friends doesn't realize the impact of the things that I do. But
yeah.
At the end, whenever I put my head to the pillow, I'm extremely satisfied because I did what I did, what I could do for the better of the world, and that's something that no amount of money can pay or get to you.
What do you think about TypeScript support in Node? What are your personal thoughts on it? I know, you know, we have Dino has TypeScript support. Bun has TypeScript support. Is that something that you think Node will ever adopt?
So before answering what I think is best is that we didn't include it in yet is that because even TypeScript team doesn't want us to vendor TypeScript, because TypeScript doesn't follow semantic versioning. So any changes can come in any version, and that's kind of really like scary situation for Node.js collaborators and maintainers. On top of that, I think the benefits of TypeScript is there's no discussion there. With JSDoc and IntelliSense, those kinds of benefits up until a certain point is also beneficial for it. And with I think there's a new proposal on TC39 for making TypeScript types as a command, so that you don't need to build and transpile your code to a like a ESM or CGS. That's also solved as well. I think without rendering TypeScript, we are extremely close to supporting TypeScript on Node.js, which is if you you just need to install loader, and you can just pass node minus minus loader equals whatever that package name is, and you can run any TypeScript module right now. And these changes are done by the Node.js modules team, including several really smart people. And without rendering TypeScript, we could literally do anything because of all of those changes that's happening to the ESM loader right now.
Yeah, when loaders came out, this was probably 3 years ago, but that's immediately what I thought. Like, maybe you can describe what loaders are, because I think it's sort of an unknown feature of Node.js, and it can make things like supporting TypeScript maybe a bit easier than people think.
So loaders are what we call, like, whenever you import or require a module, before resolving that particular file, the contents of the file, we pass it to a hook, and you can tap in and mutate the contents of the file. So if that file is a TypeScript, you can dynamically compile that TypeScript file into a JavaScript and then return JavaScript from that file without updating or building it. This is extremely beneficial because this means that the contents doesn't matter. It can be mutated or updated or changed dynamically by a third-party application, which enables those kinds of improvements. So yeah,
One of the loaders that I think, I'm not sure if it's being written or not, but I just found out that CSS modules, I didn't even realize this, CSS modules is a ECMA spec, and the way that you can import CSS modules into JavaScript is via a loader. Is that right?
I don't know. Maybe it's past
what you're doing. Yeah.
Yeah, but I thought that was kind of interesting. If it's a CSS file or if it's something else, like, you can basically do anything. You can just load a macOS application. You can load Rust code in Node.js. If you so right now we have an FFI, but it's an open PR, and we can basically compile Rust dynamically and enable it as a module by using FFI with no changes.
Oh.
So you can basically run Rust or whatever language that you want.
That's cool. Because Scott just wrote a really cool loader for our own website. You want to talk about that, Scott? Or not a loader, a Rust file.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, just you know, trying to get my hands dirty a little bit in the Rust world. So I wrote like a script that is checking to make sure we have the right thing set up, the right ENV variables, you know, duplicating from an example if the example has been updated, but the personal ENV, basically just trying to get somebody onboarded into the site, seeding the database and those types of things.
Yeah. Nice.
Oh, yeah.
That's pretty cool. But you have to compile that and ship that with the repo, right? Because it's
correct.
It's native. Yeah. So this FFI feature might help us.
So you can basically if there's a Rust compiler that has if it's a Rust compiler in NPM, you can basically call that, compile it, and make it an executable and execute that function or through child process or whatever. You don't even need to call FFI, and then return the response of that to there. It's possible.
So you could write a loader that requires a compiler that you NPM installed and then return the compiled Rust from that.
Yes.
Wow. So,
like, basically, because it's an async, you can do that whenever you require a Rust function. It might compile it. If it's not compiled, it can create a child process or a worker thread, execute that. If it's child process, it could execute it and return the std out by the output of the loader. And then you would just get the response and you executed it.
Cool.
So yeah, there's like, regarding this, like, the limit is yourself. Like, you can literally do anything. And that's what frightens me the most and also what makes me excites me the most.
Yeah.
And Node.js is, people are going to groan when they hear us, but stay with us because I think it's actually really necessary. Node.js is getting a config file. Is that what you're working on right now?
Yes. Right now, whoa, I am working on a config file, which basically is a JSON file that you can pass any node options to Dash. The main reason for this change is that there is a limit to what you can give to the arguments because of the operating system limitations. Mm-hmm. So if you have a file system, if you have a config file, it's extremely easy. And because I recently added SimJSON, which is a super fast library written by Daniel Lemire, it's really easy to parse and super fast parse JSON file.
Oh, and people are probably thinking, like, don't we already have a config file, which is the package.json? Why do we need another config file? And I'll say real quick, the idea with the config file is that, like, you often have different NPM scripts, right? And you have, like, a dev command, and you have a production command, and maybe you'll have, like, another command that runs it in with a bunch of different flags added to it. And like you said, that gets kind of unruly, where you have all of these flags. So with a config file, I could set, like, all right, I want debug, maybe a port value, anything specific to that type of running instance. Is that right?
So, yeah. So the issue is that even though we bundle NPM, Node project and NPM project is extremely different projects, and it has different goals. I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah.
The other thing is that because of how the ESM and CGS loaders are implemented, if you execute a node index.js command, it will check for a package JSON in your current directory up until to your root directory. So if you are under /users, yagis, desktop, coding, blah, blah, it will make 7, 8 different file system operations trying to find the package.json. This is mostly done because that package.json contains either type module or type common JS. So you know how to load an ESM module, whether you should call a ESM module or a common JS module. So if you have lots of configurations in here, we tend to do it. ESLint has support for having a key in package.json. Prettier has it. A lot of Volta has it. A lot of different packages has it. And if you make this package.json file really big, then it becomes a performance bottleneck because then you need to parse that huge JSON file and trying to find the values that you care most, which is name, type, exports, imports, and one more thing that I forgot. So, and using a config file is extremely optional. We don't want, I don't want to affect any existing applications in terms of performance. So we shouldn't encourage people to use package.json as a key value storage because that's not the intention of it. I don't know the backstory of how package.json become package.json, but for the sake of it, it's important. But what you can do is that if you want to use a package.json, of course, you can just you just need to run node with node config file is equal to package.json. And if you have those specific key value pairs, then you can use it as a config file as well. But that's not the intention because we basically check for a JavaScript, we check for a JSON file, and that JSON file is technically package.json is also a JSON file. But so it can be used, but if it's highly unlikely, and it's I don't recommend it at all for performance reasons. Awesome.
And that, what was it? The JSON lib that you included, what was that called again?
SIMD JSON.
SIMD JSON, yeah. I'm just quickly Googling. Does that support JSON 5, which is not a standard, but it's the better way of writing JSON? Because I've always wanted to be able to use trailing commas and put comments in my JSON in Node.js, but I've made issues many times, specifically in the NPM repo, and they've closed it saying it would cause too much breakage to the community.
So the thing is, JSON is a specification. JSON 5 isn't, as far as I know.
No, it's not.
And yeah, SimJSON doesn't support it because it goes for validity of the JSON file.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Biome and other implementers, they support these kinds of things. And they even support having faulty JSON, but also continuing to parse the remaining values. But we don't. And I don't think SIMJSON supports it as well.
Okay.
But SIMJSON is the fastest JSON parser, I think, in the world right now. So yeah.
6 gigabytes a second to minify JSON. Validate at 13 gigs a second. It's true. Like you think about podcast, people who run podcast studios or podcast apps, they have to download gigs and gigs and gigs of XML. There's probably other people that have to download gigs and gigs of JSON as well.
Yep. So SIMJSON is written by, again, Daniel Lemire, the professor that I worked with on Ada URL parser. So yeah, it's an extremely well-optimized library. So we are currently using SIMJSON with package.json resolver. So whenever you find the correct one, we parse that package.json and retrieve the important ones.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, with that PR, I think ESM and CGS applications just got 5% faster. So that's the impact of a library like this.
It's amazing. It's amazing to have such a big impact with such a small change. I know that's been a kind of a theme throughout this conversation. But yeah, wow. It's really, really awesome.
Yeah. Well, by the way, that PR was 120,000 lines of code because I included SIMJSON as a dependency to note. But the actual code change was around maybe 1,000 lines or 800 lines. But it's extremely small. And we just need to look into the code base and try to find those kinds of bottlenecks, and even small things can have really huge impacts. But unfortunately, because companies doesn't want to spend money and they don't want to sponsor or whatever their internal agenda is, we don't have that much improvements.
Thank you so much for all of that stuff on Perf in general. I mean, I think a lot of it is like pretty eye-opening to the challenges that, you know, the Node team or any developers face here. I think now where we want to go with the show is take it in the part of sick picks and shameless plugs, where you can bring us a sick pick, which is something that you just like right now, and a shameless plug, something you want to plug, something you want people to check out.
Okay, so for sick picks, I can say that I'm a huge fan of Rust-based linters, including Biome. But there's also a new kid in town, which is OXC. It's written by Boshen and is maybe 3 times faster than Biome, but doesn't have any formatter right now, but the linter is extremely fast. So I really like that.
Wow, I never heard of this. A JavaScript oxidation compiler. And a
I'm going to tell you, Wes, I heard about it this morning while I was looking through Yagit's Twitter and found a retweet about this, and I was like, I've never heard of this.
Yeah, I'm a sucker for performance tools, so I really like those kinds of things.
Yeah, we've been hearing just this week everybody's talking about Biome, and now I'm hearing about this. I think it's really cool because linters and formatters.
And the good side is Boshen. Yeah, the Boshen was a contributor to Biome in the past in Rome.
Okay,
and so, yeah, but the performance, if you look into the benchmarks, it's extremely good. And what I really like about the project is that there's this extremely good quote saying that performance issues are considered as a bug in this project. That's what he said. And it's like that tells something about the character of a project, and that I really like and respect.
Yeah. Yeah.
Man, if somebody can figure out how to parse and maybe replicate some of the ESLint configs, but in Rust. I don't know if that's possible.
They did. They did. Rome did it. Yeah, Rome did it. And OXC, so Boshen is also one by one moving ESLint rules to OXC. I think he just did Unicorn, ESLint config Unicorn.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like maybe 500 different rules or whatever. I don't know. The impact is huge. And for it, I think the one of the lead engineers of Vue told wrote on Twitter saying that running OXE on the Vue repository takes 50 milliseconds on 200 enabled rules. And it's how is that possible? Node.js?
200 rules on 590. Yeah, Evan, you. 200 rules on 590 files finished in 50. That's true because, like, I'm starting to see sometimes in my editor, specifically in our Svelte project, is sometimes I hit save twice in order for the linter to catch up. It'll show me an old error.
Yes.
And I'm like, no, I fixed that. And you have to hit save again. I don't know if that's in the saving or in the parsing of it, but that's awesome.
So Node.js is initialized. So if you run a console log hello world on a Node.js project, it takes 150 milliseconds because of the V8 bottleneck.
Yeah.
And with Rust applications, it's extremely optimized, so you don't need to do it. And if you're a good engineer, just like Boshan, then you can basically go for IO bound, which is the limitation of the computer itself. And this is what's happening in here.
Holy. So it's three times faster than a console log to lint your entire project. That's awesome.
And this is why, even though I really like ESLint projects and they really revolutionized the industry and Node.js applications, they are unfortunately doomed to lose that particular point because of how these super optimized linters are coming. But one bottleneck in the scenario is that because they're run on Rust and they don't have any JavaScript context, all of the configurations in all of these projects, they are not pluggable. I can't add a new rule without contributing to Biome or OXE. So hopefully they will find a solution which is worth it. Like, even if we write a rule in Rust, I'm okay with it. But
We had Nicholas Zakis, who's the author of ESLint, on, and he's like, we can't ever rewrite the whole thing in Rust because, like, you need to be able to let the community author this stuff in JavaScript. But there are many parts of ESLint that can be rewritten in Rust, especially parsing all of the files and parsing the JavaScript.
So this is what I did with PMPM. 5 months ago, I started rewriting PMPM with Rust. And I even, it's called Paquet, PACQUET, which is under PMPM organization right now. But eventually, those kinds of projects, they need more than one collaborator to finish it. And the question becomes, so for the case of Rust, even writing super fast Rust is extremely hard. Because right now, then, if you are comparing single thread to different, like single thread Rust and single thread Node.js, Node.js is almost fast if you write the code really good. Mm-hmm. But if you write multi-thread, then the question becomes, how can I write a really performant multi-threaded application? And then the real engineering comes in that you don't have to think about in any Node.js applications because it's single thread.
Yeah, I was doing I was trying to write a video encoding app, and I was doing a frame by frame of raw video. And I mean, those are just massive vectors. And when I went to do it single threaded in Rust, immediate frame rate bottlenecks and all sorts of things. And now I have to get into multi-threading, which is something I've never had to think about as a web developer in my entire life. And it was shocking to me how much a small dive into that world was able to unlock a lot more performance for me in my project, get me to, 60 FPS, what I was trying to hit. And it was just, it was a nuts experience to actually see that type of world in action.
So there is this particular gray area that most people don't know or don't want to contribute, is that before going into multi-threading, you could just use SIMD instructions, which is single instruction, multiple data, which means that if you have a for loop and if you have 100 elements, instead of going one by one, if your computer allows it, you can go 16 by 16 and iterate it in the less amount of time on a single thread. So I think on Rust, SIMD is still experimental, which is a extremely bad case. But on C++, on those kinds of things, this is what people use. And for video processing, SIMD is extremely useful because of all of these really big matrices that you need to traverse and analyze.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Mine was definitely more of a, I'm exploring rather than trying to make anything useful out of this. But yeah, interesting. Cool.
All right. Last thing is a shameless plug. What would you like to plug to the audience?
I don't know. My Twitter account. If you care about any performance, I recommend following me. I like to write some blogs on my personal website, which is yagiz.co. You could just follow there.
You're a great follow on Twitter, by the way.
Yeah.
I love seeing all.
I don't BS. That's why I don't BS. I only care about posting quantifiable data. So that's why, I guess. But yeah, thank you.
Yeah,
it's good to hear that, because that's where the real engineering comes in, and I want to be known for the engineering, not for the BS.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. I know it sometimes brings the heat, but it's a good follow. Well, and also, for everyone listening, we have a Twitter list of all of our guests, so we'll throw you on there as well. Thank you so much for coming on. Appreciate all your time. This was awesome, and we'll catch you later.
Thank you.
Peace.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.